Good morning and welcome to our October term of court, which is held here on the campus of Black Hills State University. It is nice to be back. The court was last here in 1999. We would like to welcome students from Black Hills State and also students from Newcastle High School. If you've not had a chance to help yourselves, we have three publications available in the lobby. The first one is a synopsis of all nine cases that we will be hearing oral argument on this term, and it also is a helpful guide to courtroom etiquette. It tells a little bit about the justices, and also it gives you our website where we put our opinions when they're issued. If you're interested in one of these cases that you're going to hear this morning, when the opinion is issued, it's posted within 24 hours on that website. That's on the back cover. The second publication we have available today is a blue-covered copy, which is a narrative of how our judicial system works in South Dakota, both at the trial level and the appellate level. And finally, the third publication we have is a pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. And I would note on page 24, we have a picture of our last visit to Black Hills State with the court visiting with students from a high school outside the building. So help yourself to any of those during the break, and we hope you find them informative. This morning, the first case for oral argument before the court is Sisters of St. Francis Appellant and St. Francis Mission, Society of Jesus and the Diocese of Rapid City, Defendants versus Lloyd One Star et al. Appellee. For the appellant, we have Ms. Sheila Woodward, an attorney from Yankton, South Dakota. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Gregory Yates, an attorney from Encino, California. Justice Sabers has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Warren Johnson, the presiding judge of the Fourth Circuit Court, located in Deadwood, to sit in his place. Ms. Woodward, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm here this morning on behalf of the Sisters of St. Francis. The Sisters is a religious order based in Denver, Colorado, and also in Alliance, Nebraska. From about the early 1920s until approximately 1972, various sisters worked at the St. Francis Indian School in St. Francis, South Dakota. That school was actually run by a group of Jesuit priests and brothers from Wisconsin, but the sisters provided a lot of labor at the school. The sisters were teachers, seamstresses, cooks, and generally provided child care because for a large portion of that time, the school was a boarding school for Native American students. In 2005, the sisters were served with a complaint by numerous former boarding school students alleging that while they attended the school, the sisters had physically and sexually abused them. The plaintiffs who alleged only physical abuse complaints against the sisters have now voluntarily dismissed their cases. So there are only two plaintiffs remaining in this case against the sisters, both of whom allege that they were sexually abused by members of the sisters' order. Those plaintiffs are Plaintiff Lloyd One Star and Plaintiff Marion Cerase. Sisters filed a motion for summary judgment before Judge Fuller at the trial court level, asking the court to dismiss the claims of Mr. One Star and Ms. Cerase because it is sisters' contention that they did not file their complaints within 3 years of the date they knew that the injuries they suffered had been caused by the sexual abuse, which is the standard set out in SDCL 26-10-25. The trial court denied that motion, and we proceeded here on an intermediate appeal this morning. SDCL 26-10-25 is what is called a discovery rule statute. The statute was passed by the legislature in 1991 to give victims of childhood sexual abuse additional time to file their complaints.
Do you see any significance in the fact that we really don't know why the trial court denied it?
No, I don't, Your Honor. just, it was a denial with no opinion and no further comment on the record.
I understand that, but is there any significance as far as summary judgment by the fact we don't know or have the benefit of the trial court's thoughts?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I believe this is a question of law, and this court reviews questions of law de novo in any event, so an opinion from the trial court I do not think would have made any difference in this court's decision since you review it de novo. The discovery statute at issue in this case has not been addressed by this court before, at least in the context of when does a claim accrue under that statute. You have, however, reviewed other discovery rule statute of limitations previously, in particular the fraud statute of limitations, which is a similar type of discovery statute. A person can bring a fraud claim within, I believe it's 6 years of when they knew of the fraud or when they reasonably should have discovered the fraud. I believe that statute uses the phrase actual or constructive notice of the fraud. The case I'm referring to that discussed that is called Strasburg. And Strasburg has two very important holdings that are, I think, applicable universally to discovery rule statutes. The first thing is that in Strasburg, this court found that the fact that the plaintiff had not discovered the full extent of their injuries at the time did not prevent the statute of limitations from accruing. In other words, the fact that the plaintiff may not know all of their injuries does not mean that the statute can accrue once the plaintiff has noticed that there is some injury that's been caused by the underlying act. And the Strasburg court cited to an Iowa Supreme Court case called Woodruff, which actually is a childhood sexual abuse case that was decided by the Iowa Supreme Court in 1995. And in Woodruff, the Iowa Supreme Court applied a common law discovery rule for childhood sexual abuse claims that is virtually identical to that we have legislatively enacted in South Dakota. And in that case, the court found that once the plaintiff knew that she had sustained some injury as a result of the childhood sexual abuse, she was on notice to proceed with her claim and could not simply wait until she had complete knowledge of every injury before filing her action. Second thing in Strasburg is that this court said that when a cause of action accrues is when a person has the information they need to bring a claim. It's a fairly simplistic formula, but the issue is when did the plaintiffs here have the information they needed to bring the claims against my client? Those claims that they brought, which are important to understand, are claims for negligent supervision, breach of fiduciary duty, and vicarious liability. They are not claims against the actual perpetrators of the abuse.
Are the actual perpetrators still alive, do you know? Or the alleged perpetrators, I guess I should say.
There are two alleged perpetrators of my client, one of whom is still alive, one of whom died several years ago.
Is the one who is still living a party to this case?
No, she is not.
And do they allege that that she abused both plaintiffs?
Yes.
Okay. For both plaintiffs, or are they alleging abuse by the same two people?
Mr. One Star claims he was abused by two different sisters. Ms. Sorace claims abuse by one sister. The sisters are in common between the two of them.
How old is this living sister now, do you know?
She's approximately 80 years old, Your Honor.
And I guess while I'm asking, how old are the plaintiffs, do you know?
I believe they would have graduated from high school in roughly 1972 or 1973. I guess that their ages are early 50s. I want to talk about the individual plaintiffs and their claims and why I believe that the undisputed facts show that the statute of limitations started to run well in advance of when they filed their claim against my client. Mr. One Star wrote a letter in May of 2001. And I want to talk about the context of why he wrote that letter. He wrote that letter in response to an advertisement in the Lakota Times that was apparently seeking plaintiffs for a class action lawsuit to sue the Catholic entities that had run the Native American boarding schools. So Mr. One Star wrote this letter It was written to a man named Vince Two Eagles. Once he wrote the letter, Mr. Two Eagles came to see Mr. One Star. With Mr. Two Eagles at this meeting was a man named Gary Frischer. I'm not entirely sure what Mr. Frischer does for a living, but Mr. One Star told me he helps people find lawyers. During the depositions in this case, when I've asked questions about Mr. Frischer, there have been objections on the grounds of attorney-client privilege. So I am assuming, based on that information that I have, that Mr. Frischer is somehow affiliated with an attorney. Mr. One Star met with Mr. Frischer. He met with Mr. Two Eagles. And according to Mr. One Star, eventually nothing, they were looking at starting a lawsuit, but nothing came out of those meetings. Prior to even writing that letter, Mr. One Star had also been in contact with another attorney in Louisiana about potentially filing a claim. So that's the context in which this letter was written by Mr. One Star. Now the letter is extremely detailed. It describes the abuse that Mr. One Star claims he suffered, who did it, where they did it, how often they did it, when they did it, and basically every other detail of the abuse that Mr. One Star has then alleged in this case. What's important about the letter is not the allegations of the abuse that's laid out by Mr. One Star, but it's the fact that Mr. One Star, in that letter, explicitly ties the abuse to his psychological injuries as an adult. He states that he knows that what was done to him at the mission school affected him his entire life, especially in his relationship with his family members, with his sons, his wife, his relationship with his spiritual relationship, his self-esteem, and his self-medicating throughout with alcohol. He points out that he's not forgotten this during his entire life, and it's had a horrible and long-lasting impact onto him on a long-term basis. That is what the South Dakota Supreme Court meant, or South Dakota Legislature meant, when they passed SDCL 26-10-25. They wanted to give victims of childhood sexual abuse ample time to bring their claims, recognizing that those victims of childhood sexual abuse may not be able to make that connection between their injuries and the abuse right away. The legislature gave them, through the discovery rule, an extended period of time to bring those actions. But Mr. One Star made that connection in May of 2001 when he wrote this letter. He's connected the abuse to his alcoholism, to his difficulty in relating to his family, to his nightmares. When we took Mr. One Star's deposition 5 years later in this case, he told us he had suffered the same injuries that he'd already related in this letter in May of 2001. With that evidence, I believe it's undisputed that the statute of limitations accrued and started to run, as far as Mr. One Star is concerned, no later than May of 2001 when he wrote this letter.
Are there any disputes on the facts that you've just related?
No, ma'am. I asked Mr. One Star during his deposition, did you write this letter? And he told me yes. Did you write the letter in May of 2001? He told me yes. The foundation for that letter is there. The date for that letter is there. And he acknowledged that he wrote that letter. As far as the claim of Marion Sorais is concerned, in 1995, Ms. Sorais began counseling with a gentleman named Ron Oney at Catholic Family Services in Rapid City. She went to that counseling at the urging of her then-boyfriend, Dr. Archie Beauvais, because she had some serious anger management issues. During the counseling, she was asked by Mr. Oney if she'd ever been sexually abused. And she told him no, because at that time, she did not remember the sexual abuse. She ultimately discontinued counseling with Mr. Oney because she did not feel it was helping her and because she didn't have the funds to continue with it. Several months after she stopped the counseling, she was, in the context of her job, she ran across a young woman who'd been sexually abused. And in her conversations with that young woman, she recalled the acts of sexual abuse that she now says were perpetrated on her while she was at St. Francis School. She immediately went home and told Dr. Beauvais that she remembered now that she'd been sexually abused. He told her, "You have to call Ron Oney, your counselor, again."
When did this conversation take place?
In 1995.
Still in 1995.
Still in 1995. That's the best timeline I have, Your Honor. Is somewhere in 1995, all of these events occurred.
How do you establish in the record the conversation took place? Do you have testimony of both parties?
I have testimony from the plaintiff, Mr. Ace.
Okay.
She called Mr. Oney then, after she had talked to Dr. Beauvais, and Mr. Oney said, "That's what I was trying to get at with your anger, the sexual abuse. You need to come back and get more counseling." She chose not to do so. Dr. Beauvais also told her she should get more counseling, but she did not follow up on that either.
But of course, just remembering that she was sexually abused isn't enough. The legislature has said not only do you have to remember it and know that you were sexually abused, but you also have to realize that there's a connection between what you're suffering now has something to do with the abuse that you had many years earlier. So what is your evidence on that, that she knows that there's a connection?
She testified that Mr. Oney told her when she called him that was what he was trying to get at when he was counseling her for her anger management issues.
But doesn't that leave the question open whether that still might not be connected to her sexual abuse?
I think courts that have taken a look at that have determined nearly universally that once a counselor tells you, in the context of your conversations with them about abuse or in counseling, once a counselor tells you, you know, hey, that might be related, you've got a duty, an affirmative duty, to follow up on that.
So you're saying she should have known, even if she didn't maybe make the connection or was in a denial state or whatever, you're saying she should have known.
Absolutely.
But can we say that as a matter of law, or is that for a jury to decide?
I think under the Strasburg case, again, if the question generally of whether a reasonable person would have known is generally a question for the jury. But when the facts are undisputed, that a reasonable person would know that based on what they were told, it's a question that can be decided by the court on summary judgment. And if you look at the cases from Iowa in particular are instructive on those issues, the Woodruff case and the Frederis case that actually was decided by the Eighth Circuit, both of those cases involve situations where the abuse victim was in counseling, had some indication from her counselor that there may be some problems, and that's when the courts ruled as a matter of law that the statute of limitations began, because there's an affirmative duty to investigate.
Would you concede that there is certainly a substantive difference between Ms. Sorace and Mr. Onefeather in terms of the amount of knowledge that they had of the connection?
Absolutely, yeah. Mr. One Star's letter is pretty unusual. I did a lot of research to see if I could find other cases where there was a letter like that. I was able to find a couple. One was the Figueroa case from the Ninth Circuit where the plaintiff had written a letter to the bishop complaining about the abuse and who had done it, and they held that was sufficient. That letter was sufficient to show that the plaintiff had enough knowledge to bring his claim. There was another case in the Ninth Circuit, I believe, MHD, that involved a student who'd written a college essay where she talked about the abuse and the effect that it had on her during her life.
Are these cases cited in your brief?
Yes, yes, they are.
Do we know today whether the anger management problem is causally related to the abuse?
Well,
from the record, I mean, is there a fact in the record that says the anger management, the emotional issue that we do know about, that there is a causal relationship?
When we asked Ms. Sorais during her deposition, what impact has this had on you? One of the things she talked about, in fact, one of the primary things she talked about was the anger problems she's had. Dealing with, she's had some spousal abuse issues and those types of things. And yes, she testified that the sexual abuse that was perpetrated on her, she felt that her anger problems were related to that. So yes, that's the evidence that's in the record at this time.
2 minutes.
Quickly on to fraudulent concealment. Fraudulent concealment has two elements, fraud and concealment. This court has previously held that where there's a fiduciary relationship between parties, the affirmative act of fraud is not at issue, but there still has to be concealment of the underlying cause of action. The best example of that is the case of Glad versus Gunderson, where the attorney was sued for not performing as his client had wished he'd perform. The court held that because the client always had knowledge of the basic operative facts, there was no concealment, and therefore no fraudulent concealment would apply. Same issue applies here. In Koenig versus Lambert, this court found fraudulent concealment in the context of a situation where a victim of abuse did not remember any of the underlying facts, did not remember that he'd been abused until approximately a year before he filed the lawsuit. In that case, the basic operative facts were concealed from the plaintiff. Here, the basic operative facts that these plaintiffs needed to bring a claim against my client for negligent supervision, for breach of fiduciary duty, for vicarious liability, have been known to them since the latest, in the case of Mr. One Star, May of 2001, and in the case of Ms. Saray, since at least 1995. So I don't believe Koenig applies in this case because of that fundamental difference in knowledge by the plaintiffs. That's different in this case than it was in Cohen.
How long does a fiduciary duty last? I mean, certainly when they're children, the sisters had a fiduciary duty to care for them and protect them. But once they become adults, and does it last? Does this duty continue on into ad infinitum until they're 50 or 60?
I would argue that it does not, Your Honor. For purposes of the briefing and the issues in this case, I assumed, based on the language in Koenig where you found a fiduciary relationship between the diocese and the victim that had gone on for many years, I believe the victim was an adult at that time, I assume for purposes of this appeal that there would be a fiduciary relationship between my clients and the plaintiffs here.
Your time has expired, Ms. Woodward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Yates, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Please, the court. Good morning, Your Honors. California, I'm from South Dakota.
Welcome back.
Thank you. A couple of things I'd like to address and try to do it in the order Your Honors have indicated in the little summary. And then touch on as I go directly what was addressed by counsel. First of all, under SDCL 26-1025, this statute begins to run from the time the appellees discovered the causal connection. The causal connection being discovered is the issue, not the injury. There's three reasons why the sexual abuse statute in the state of South Dakota is special and distinguishable from the other states and cases which are addressed in the sisters, the appellant's brief. The first is the burden of proof is different. It's an affirmative defense. It's not an exception. Second, the discovery aspect of it is different. And I'll address that in a little more detail. Reasonable person versus reasonable person suffering from sexual abuse, childhood sexual abuse. And then this court has given great deference to the finder of fact as exemplified by the Strasburg decision, and many of the other states or jurisdictions don't necessarily give that kind of deference.
Of course, since this is a summary judgment, we give no deference, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. This is de novo. But in terms of the trial court's view of it, what constitutes reasonable discovery should be based upon what the first thing I'd like to address, actually, let me go back a little bit and just, I'm not even sure I need to touch on this. I don't want to tell the court what the court has told us, but just some brief points to show what I believe is the context of what we're looking at and why the discovery rule as articulated by counsel is not applicable. As this court has so, I believe, eloquently articulated, construed the statute in question, there is a delay in these situations of the victim's understanding the true significance of the abuse and the self-concealing nature of the abuse and sexual violation, which is significant and recognized by the statute in this court, and that a cause of action doesn't necessarily accrue when the first manifestations of injury occur. And I think that's directly on point to both appellees in this case, and I'll touch on that in a little more detail. And then finally, the involuntary coping mechanisms that are recognized by the statute legislatively and by this court in making the causal connection. And the inability to perceive the consequences, as the Hammer case that this court cited recognizes. So given that context, Your Honors, we come to the what I believe to be the appropriate standard in terms of the reasonable person standard to apply to this case, and that would be what were the specific sexual abuse facts that the victim was involved in? And the reason I think it has to be looked at and viewed at that way is because the statute directly addresses victim, not person. To that extent, how can the victim be held at the same standard as myself, the ordinary reasonable person who has not been subjected to sexual abuse, childhood sexual abuse? Because of the self-concealing nature that this court has recognized of the childhood sexual abuse, and because of the competing preservation of sanity, how can the same standard be applied to a victim of childhood sexual abuse? So, with that in mind, I think that the appellant's reliance upon the flawed discovery rule, which is an exception situation as opposed to an affirmative defense anyway, the flawed discovery rule, would it literally eviscerate the legislative policy and, for that matter, the policy as profoundly construed by this court of 26-10-25. And then again, even if this court were to apply the Strasburg analysis, the court has recognized great and given great deference to the finder of fact.
Let me make sure I understand what you're saying. Are you suggesting that the standard should be from the perspective of the individual victim and what they knew and discovered?
Yes,
Your Honor. Not the reasonable person.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that is...
Is that your argument?
Yes.
Well, then let me ask you this. The statute says discovered or reasonably should have discovered. Now, anytime the legislature uses words like reasonably should have discovered, that's law school 101, reasonable man, quote-unquote, language. Aren't we right back to not looking at this from the perspective of the individual, the subjective knowledge and thoughts of the individual? A jury's going to be instructed that the victim should be judged by whether she or he reasonably should have discovered the injury. And that's the reasonable person standard. So I don't understand how you're walking away from the statutory language.
Well, Your Honor, and I think that the statute is instructive on that because it talks about, and this court has interpreted it, it recognizes the unique circumstances of childhood sexual abuse. As this court has articulated, it's a self-concealing situation to preserve sanity. And given that context, I think that was the legislative intent, that, that it should be viewed without that, without construing it in that manner, we're subjecting the victim of childhood sexual abuse to a standard of a reasonable man without considering the self-concealing nature of
You're not saying that we look at these particular plaintiffs. You're saying a reasonably, I hate to say it that way, but someone who's been abused.
Yes.
We should look at it from
the
reasonable perspective of someone who's been abused.
Correct.
All right, thank you. Okay.
Even assuming that, and I'm going to address them individually, but for right now, both of the appellees did indicate they, you know, they were aware, recalled certain situations where they were abused. Sarace in 95, and again, she indicated that she read an article in 02, and then she also read something that her brother had written in 03. But even assuming that those are recognition and knowledge of the sexual abuse that she endured, there's no indication that she had any, since she made any causal connection between her recognition of the abuse and the conditions from which she suffered. And this is verified by the counselor that saw her, Dr. Snow. It's also, I think the unique facts of the 95 incident militate, if ever, the fact that she was not recognizing the connection. She chose not to go back to see Dr. Oney. All that is a situation where she said she finally recalled that she was sexually abused as a child. So it's basically an early manifestation of the injury. It's not a connection. The causal connection is not made. As to Mr. One Star, the letter is... Obviously, he's discussing the fact that he has made, and I think in his affidavit as well as the report of Dr. Snow and his affidavit, it becomes clearer that what he's finally done because of someone contacting him, whether it was an ad in the newspaper asking for people who might want to be members of a class action or whatever, he became aware of the fact that there was some significance to his abuse. He wrote a letter in response to that, whatever it was, ad about the potential class action. The fact that he wrote the letter and acknowledged the early manifestations, as I see it, of the abuse that he was finally connecting the dots on does not, in my opinion, Your Honors, resolve as a matter of law whether or not he had made the causal connection. He said in his deposition that it wasn't until sometime in 02 that he actually made that connection, that he actually started to make that connection. I can't imagine a victim of childhood sexual abuse who finally recalls it and not, that they would not know that in some way that that affected them. There, it's presumed, I believe. So,
but knowing isn't the... The statute doesn't say you should reasonably should have known. The statute says reasonably should have discovered. Doesn't that change the, our analysis?
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor, it does. Reasonably should have known. And that goes to the heart of the difference between the discovery rule, the notice inquiry rule, and what this legislature has made very clear, very, very specifically addressed, and this court has construed. So I believe there's a question of fact as to Mr. One Star as well.
Would there be any factual situation where it wouldn't be a question of fact?
Huh? You know, Your Honor, that I was asking.
It's speculation, but yeah. Are you basically arguing the way the statute's written, pretty much everybody will survive a summary judgment challenge because of what they knew and when they knew it?
I think almost always it's going to be a question of fact because of the legislative intent which is apparent in 2610-25. Obviously, there are going to be situations where that's not the case. But the legislature was very concerned about a very serious problem for mankind, which is childhood sexual abuse and the self-concealing nature of that ghastly event in their life. So when in doubt, all doubts should be resolved in favor of the victim of that abuse. That's what I believe the legislature is saying. I believe that that's what this court is saying. So I don't believe Mr. One Star can be held as a matter of law to say that he discovered, made the connections of the conditions. And I believe there's a question of fact, not just based upon what he said in 01, what he said about in his deposition about his 02, finally started to make some connections, but also what Dr. Snow said. And I would like to address the fact that just because someone sees a lawyer, I mean, if there's an ad in the newspaper about someone being affected by Vioxx, and they call and say, I took Vioxx, that doesn't mean, and that's a different standard, but, I mean, the example is, that doesn't mean that they have made a connection. And if this kind of statute was applicable to that situation, merely calling a lawyer because there's an ad, have you been sexually abused at a boarding school, or seeing a psychologist doesn't establish that that causal connection has been made.
But you know, looking at this, I know analogies are poor, but I'm trying to analogize this. If somebody stops on the street and they're a doctor or a nurse and they say, I see that spot on your hand, you should have that checked out. That could be cancer. And you could say, all right, well, that person, that doesn't mean they should know it's cancer. You shouldn't know it's cancer because someone stops you and says it could be cancer. But shouldn't that also mean that they should have discovered that it was cancer? And once someone that you know is a medical person tells you, that's kind of what happened here Ms. Soares, where a mental health professional is saying to her, this could be what we're getting at here. And isn't that what the statute gets to, too? Reasonably should have discovered. At that point, you can no longer say, well, I'm just not going to think about it.
I respectfully take a different view, Your Honor.
Please do. I'm inviting you to help me understand.
I don't think that's what the legislature intended. Certainly that would be the case in a malpractice case because inquiry notice kicks in. This is not an inquiry notice statute. So whether
it says reasonably should have discovered, that you're saying that is not an inquiry notice statute?
It's not an obligation to go out and investigate whether or not there's some connection. It's just whether an event or a cathartic situation suddenly occurs, whether seeing a doctor, seeing a lawyer, reading something in the newspaper, watching on TV, reading in the newspaper about the sexual abuse cases, whatever the case might be, and suddenly this connection is made. And the causal connection that is set forth in this 261025 does not call for an inquiry type, as it would be in a malpractice case or other situations type. That's my interpretation of your garage.
What does the word should mean then? The legislature said should have.
If there's
no obligation of inquiry, what would that mean? Why would they have used the word should?
Well, as this court has articulated, we have the phenomenon of the self-concealing nature of childhood sexual abuse, if only to preserve someone's sanity. That has to be taken into consideration and viewed in the context of that, and that is what this statute is talking about, as I view it, Your Honor. That militates against the typical notice inquiry expectation or reasonable person expectation. I wanted to address briefly fraudulent concealment, but I don't want to move on until... If there's any other questions to the court in this area, I would...
Just get to move on.
Okay. Fraudulent concealment is an issue, I think, as well in this case. And then I want to try to touch on, depending on my time, class action tolling. Actually, let me address class action tolling first. As to Mr. One Star, he's a named plaintiff. He's not a putative plaintiff in the class action. It was filed, and it named the boarding schools as a partner with the United States government. He filed that within the statutory time, and therefore the tolling would apply directly to him. The national publicity that was received in this case, the schools and the church officials were interviewed. Mr. One Star talked specifically about what one of the sisters did to him. Not going into the detail, by the way, and that's another thing counsel mentioned, that everything was discussed in that May 1st letter. It wasn't. The details of the sexual abuse was not discussed in the May 1st letter. That was not discussed until he had a visit with Dr. Snow. In any event, the purpose of class action tolling is to, and that's recognized by this state, is to prevent unnecessary litigation, but also the tolling should only be applied generally to named defendants. But in this case, where there's an alter ego, identity of interest situation, the policy behind normally it just being named defendants does not apply, because it is a situation where the defendants, the church defendants, specifically the appellant in this case,
2 minutes,
had knowledge that these claims were being made against them. Thank you, Your Honor. As to the fraudulent concealment, the Koenig decision involved the same diocese, the Rapid City Diocese. And in that case, this court recognized that it was during the same time frame. This court recognized the fraudulent concealment aspect in that case. The Rapid City Diocese had a duty to disclose the widespread ongoing abuse. It didn't. It didn't disclose it to authorities. It didn't warn. It didn't undertake its duty to protect, which the duty to protect in this case is not, there are not operative facts that the victims could be said to have known as it applied to the operative facts of the liability.
What did Mr. One Star have concealed from him after he wrote that letter?
I'm sorry.
What did Mr. One Star have concealed from him after he wrote that lengthy letter explaining what happened to him and what he felt it did to him?
Well, he certainly had concealed from him the operative facts of liability of the negligent supervision, failure to protect on the part of the defendants, and in this case, the named defendant, the appellant.
But is that the law requires that he have knowledge of the causal connection? You're saying that wasn't concealed from him at that point, was it?
Causal connection as to what was concealed from him was any knowledge with respect to the facts that would be operative as to the liability of the appellant in this case, other than the appellant's age.
He'd have to have knowledge of the legal requirements as opposed to simply knowing that I was sexually abused, what's happened to me in my life now, what's the suffering I've gone through since then is connected to that sexual abuse. He would have to know more than that. He would have to know all the legal ramifications. Is that what you're saying?
Not all the legal ramifications, but he would have to have some knowledge as to the elements of the cause of action against the appellant in this case.
Give us an example. Give us an example of what one of the defendants should have disclosed.
Well,
that these are the elements of negligent supervision that I'm having trouble understanding how far to take this, because you acknowledge operative facts is the black letter test, but you're asking us to say that they should also disclose liability. How would they do that? Give me an example.
Well, it's the liability of the appellant in this case is based upon the failure to protect, having knowledge, constructive notice or actual notice of the fact that there's widespread ongoing abuse, that some of their employees, their agents are involved in that, that there's reports of that, whether it be their observations or whatever it is. And Koenig recognized that that was ongoing in the Rapid City Diocese. And also, the you have the aspect of this is not only a situation where there's a fiduciary duty that arises out of the clergy-parishioner relationship, but as well as you have the teacher-student in loco parentis relationship. So when you take that into consideration, I think it should be determined as a matter of law that that fraudulent concealment doctrine should not apply merely because they are aware that someone in the employ of the appellant abused them.
Your time has expired, Mr. Yates.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Woodward, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you. I'm going to start right with the fraudulent concealment issue. The basic operative facts that someone needs to know to file a negligent supervision claim is, one, an employee of the person harmed them, and two, who was the employer of the person. I mean, that's largely what a negligent supervision claim is. Mr. One Star and Ms. Sorace knew the facts sufficient to file a claim against my client for negligent supervision, as long as they knew who the people were that abused them and when it happened. That's really the basic elements of a negligent supervision cause of action. There was nothing hidden from these folks. You know, we didn't hide our identity. We didn't change our name. We didn't do anything like that. There's just no evidence of concealment.
Are there allegations here? I know that we have another case just similar to this coming up next, but are there allegations here that the nuns threatened them, told them to be silent, or that they would be punished by God if they revealed what happened, that kind of thing?
There's absolutely no specific allegation that the nuns said anything. There is a generic affidavit. It's an affidavit that Mr. One Star and Ms. Sorace filed in this case that is identical to the affidavits you will see in the next case that generally says we were in fear of our mortal souls and those types of things. But there is no allegation.
So that could be a pretty powerful thing that a religious figure tells a child, you know, you better keep quiet because it's not just me who could come back. It's the Lord who could punish you for, you know, betraying your faith. That potentially is the kind of thing they're talking about in fraudulent concealment, isn't it?
To a certain extent, yes, but the concealment is the hiding of the cause of action. I would say the argument as far as the God will hurt you if you, you know, don't do what we say is more of a duress issue than it is a fraudulent concealment issue. And I'd again just like to emphasize that there is absolutely no evidence in the record that any sister made these statements in this case. So also want to talk about 2610.25. I don't have right in my head the definition of what an inquiry notice statute is, but I am virtually positive that STCL 2610.25 is an inquiry notice statute. Did the plaintiff discover or did they reasonably should have discovered? That is the essence of inquiry notice. In the cases that we've cited on accrual, in Iowa and Nebraska, where they're applying a common law discovery rule, that common law discovery rule that those courts are applying is nearly identical to what the South Dakota legislature set forth in 2610.25. They're requiring the plaintiff not just to remember the injury or the act of abuse, but to make the connection between that injury and the abuse. That's what the common law discovery rules is about, and that's what the South Dakota legislature passed. What the legislature didn't do, however, was get rid of the statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse claims. The legislature could have done that. Other states have just completely gotten rid of the statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse claims. We did not do that in South Dakota. I'd like to hope it's because the legislature realized that we have to strike some sort of balance here between the rights of childhood sexual abuse victims and the rights of the people who are accused decades later of that abuse.
One sister can't contradict what's being alleged against her. She's dead.
That's correct. And every mother superior that was at the school during those decades is now either incompetent or dead. There is, statute of limitations have a purpose. Their purpose is not to defeat meritorious claims, but their purpose is to strike a balance between people being able to bring their meritorious claims while recognizing that the farther and farther away you get from the underlying act, the harder it is for anyone to prove whether the claim is indeed meritorious. Memories fade, people die, documents are lost. The legislature struck a balance with this statute when it gave a great deal of leeway to the victims of childhood sexual abuse to have the time to make the connection between their injuries and the underlying abuse, but it did not get rid of the statute of limitations entirely. I believe it's a meritorious defense. I believe my clients are entitled to assert it based on the statute. And I believe that the legislature has struck a balance between the two competing issues. I also want to talk quickly about Dr. Snow's affidavit. Dr. Snow, what's important is what Dr. Snow doesn't say. What Dr. Snow says is that neither Mr. One Star nor Ms. Serrace connected the childhood sexual abuse to the clinical diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder until they met with him the day before their depositions were taken in this case. He does not say that they did not connect the injuries to the abuse. He says they did not connect post-traumatic stress disorder. That's a completely different issue, and that's not what the statute requires. The statute requires a connection between the abuse and the underlying injury. And Mr. One Star made that connection. His letter is, I know counsel for the plaintiff said that the letter doesn't address the abuse. It's three single-spaced pages addressing the abuse that happened to him. It also addresses his psychological injuries and how it's harmed him and his relationships as an adult. Ms. Serrace similarly was told by her counselor in 1995, hey, you know, we should look at this. And she chose not to go back to counseling. And I believe that statute, as Justice Zinter pointed out, requires that it states that the plaintiff discovered or reasonably should have discovered. So the question for Ms. Serrace is, when your counselor tells you, you know, there might be a connection here, does that mean that she should have discovered as a matter of law that there's a connection between her injury and the abuse at that time?
But can we make that decision as a matter of law rather than have the jury decide that?
I believe you can. This court has previously held that when the question is whether, when there are undisputed facts as to what happened, whether a reasonable person would have done something, the court could make that decision as a matter of law. That was the Strasburg decision that mentioned that. I'd also point to the Kraft case.
How do we decide that, though? I mean, what are we actually saying if we decide that as a matter of law?
I think what you're saying there as a matter of law is that a plaintiff who goes to see a counselor and is told by that counselor that there could be a connection between the abuse and the injury, as a matter of law, triggers the statute of limitations and the plaintiff's duty to bring her claim in South Dakota. That's what Iowa has held. That's what the Eighth Circuit applying Nebraska law has held as well. Also, we have case law in South Dakota that does state that when you consult with a lawyer, that is potential evidence that you're on inquiry notice, that you have a potential claim against someone. So when Mr. One Star wrote the letter in response to the class action advertisement and consulted with Mr. Frischer, that is a suggestion under South Dakota law. It's the Brusky versus Hilly case cited in our brief, and also an Eighth Circuit case called Joyner. That is the suggestion that if you know enough to go see a lawyer about bringing a claim, then you've got notice that you better get that claim filed within the statute of limitations. Finally, I'm just going to touch on class action tolling very quickly. My client was not a defendant in the class action lawsuit filed by Mr. One Star against the federal government. That class action lawsuit involved claims against the federal government for violating Indian treaties. It was also filed in federal court, not state court. In Peterson versus Holm, this court held that filing a medical malpractice case in federal court in South Dakota was not sufficient to toll the state statute of limitations when that case was later dismissed and then refiled in South Dakota. That case involved the identical parties and the identical claims, and yet this court held that they were not going to do what I would call cross-jurisdictional tolling of the statute of limitations. For those reasons, there's different parties, there's different claims, it's different jurisdictions. Class action tolling does not apply here at all.
At the time your client was supervising the school, was there any significant relationship with the federal government, or was it strictly a church-run school?
What my clients did at the school, Your Honor, was teaching, and they were not really supervising at the school. They were the teachers and the Jesuit brothers supervised the school. To my knowledge, my clients had no contact with the federal government.
So there was no partnership between the federal government and the Catholic Church or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.